Tomorrow evening, I will be talking about engaging our life out there, and then we'll do the closing circle on Tuesday. I wanted to do at least one talk on this retreat in which I pushed the envelope a little bit, maybe jumped off a cliff or something, so tonight's my last shot at it. I was thinking about what would the Buddha teach if he were living today, rather than 2,500 years ago. You know, is there any teachings he might, add that weren't included back then, which is really terribly presumptuous thing for me to think about, but what the heck. So tonight I want to talk about the infinitely expanding self. And as I'd like to do, I will start with a story. Jean Houston was one of the early pioneers of the human potential movement. Remember that back in the late 50s and into the 60s. But when she was younger, she was living on the Upper East Side in New York City. And one morning, she was racing down the sidewalk, late for her school bus, as usual. And she whipped around a corner and ran smack into this elderly gentleman, knocking them both off their feet. "I'm sorry, sir, I'm sorry, sir," and trying to help him up. And he looked up at her and he said, "Young lady, are you always going to be in such a hurry all your life?" "Well, I don't know, sir, I don't know, sir. I guess so, sir." And he looked at her and he smiled and he said, "Well then, bon voyage." In the following days, they saw each other on the street around there, and they chatted a little bit, and the conversations got longer. And she couldn't quite get his name. He spoke in this very heavy French accent. It sounded like tear or tear or something like that. And she took to calling him Mr. Thayer. And pretty soon, Jean Houston and Mr. Thayer were taking these long, rambling walks in Central Park together. And he had this wonderful, bright, playful spirit. "John, John," he would say, "come, come, look at this, look at this. Look at this little caterpillar walking along this leaf with all those little legs. How does he know to work all of those together? Oh, look at this. John, John, look over here, look at this spider web. How does she know how to spin that beautiful web?" He just seemed completely enchanted with the natural world. Then she didn't see him for a few days. And a few days more, and a few days more, and she was concerned about him, but she couldn't check on him because she didn't actually know where he lived. And then one day she saw a lowdown on one of the pages in the New York Times. There was his photograph. "Mom, it's Mr. Thayer." And the caption said, "On Sunday evening of Easter, Thayer de Chardin had a heart attack and died." Thayer de Chardin was a Jesuit priest. He had been censored by the church for some of his far-out ideas in this manuscript called The Phenomena of Man. And the church didn't know quite what to do with him. So they sent him to live out his remaining years at the Church of St. Ignatius Loyola on Park Avenue. So Jean Houston had been rambling in Central Park with one of the 20th century's greatest mystics and theologians. And I just love the image of this old man with his sparkling eyes looking up at this young woman and wishing her this buoyant bon voyage. And I love the image of rambling in the park with this elderly priest who just loved the caterpillars and spiders and the trees and the bushes and the woods and the sun and all of that. He was, his sense of self didn't seem to cling to anybody, but was just out there, merged with the world. So what would that be like? To have an awareness that is so relaxed and so expanded that it just loses its boundaries and moves out into the world. What would it be like to have an awareness that is crisp and clear as a spring morning, and yet not weighed down by thoughts about my body, my personality, my person. What would it be like to be Thiers de Chardin, merged with the wonders of life itself? So tonight I want to talk about this infinitely expanding self as embodied, as illustrated by Thiers de Chardin. The Buddha, as I've said before, never said that we have no self. It just said we have no eternal self-essence that separates us from everything else. So we could call this selflessness, non-self, anatta, or we could call it an infinite self that expands so much that it includes everything. Right?
We could call it bon voyage.
We could call it bon voyage. Yes. Yeah. So whether you try to shrink down and disappear or expand out to everything, they move in different directions, but it really arrives at the same place. T.S. Eliot wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time." The path of selflessness or non-self was probably much more accessible to people in the Buddha's time for reasons that I want to get into. It'll take me a while, but we'll get into it tonight. But the path of this infinitely expanding self, I think, is more available to us today. Again, they lead in opposite directions, but they arrive at the same place. Pardon? Oh, the two paths. Non-self, infinite self. They seem to point in opposite directions, but actually end up in the same place. Nevertheless, there is this sense of a separate self that just so automatically colors our thoughts that I can't help but think that anything so powerful has to be deeply wired into us, and it must have had some evolutionary advantage at some point. And it's not hard to imagine what that might have been. So if we imagine two people walking through the primeval forest, and the first one is just at one, with the birds and the caterpillars and the spiders and the wolves and the bears and the saber-toothed kitties and the forest and all that. He just ambles along peacefully. His life is very content and probably very short. His real mellow demeanor makes him easily turns him into a snack for some large carnivore. The other one is spooked by every rustle, every shadow. He thinks he has a sense of a self he must preserve. He scurries through empty spaces, you know, like open fields, like a paranoid squirrel. His life is rather anxious and long. So guess whose DNA we inherited? When we were a marginal species in a world filled with powerful carnivores, ferocious carnivores, there really was no evolutionary advantage for having this sense of being out there with all of life, and every advantage for feeling like we had a dense self that we have to protect this body. And, you know, it worked. It worked. Today we have contained or wiped out every species that poses a significant existential threat to our existence. We're the top of the food chain now. So our desire to protect our existence is probably the biggest threat to our continuing existence. We've become our own enemy. And yet, the sense of a separate self is just wired into her system. The Buddha called it bhava-tana, the desire to exist as a separate individual. It's what's known as an anusya. Any of you familiar with that term? Underlying tendency. Yeah. An anusya, it's like a hidden hindrance. It's a hindrance that's there and always seems to operate in the background, but it's difficult to see. So, for example, with the sense of self, one of the places it's triggered is when there's a threat. But when there's a threat, all our attention goes out there rather than in here. That may sound a little esoteric, but bhava-tana, this selfing, the effects of it are not esoteric at all. We're in big trouble in the 21st century, as we all know. The species extinction rate is skyrocketing. Our political system is getting bogged down in petty ego battles. You can see all of these flow out of this hyper-developed sense of self. Economic system is degenerating into a set of rules that favors a few rule makers and ignores everyone else. Climate change is a result of sophisticated technology alongside an immature belief that somehow we think our well-being can be separated from the environment around us. Gandhi once said that the degree of civilization is not measured by the gross national product, but how the people care for the poor, the sick, the oppressed. And so this reporter piped up and asked him what he thought about Western civilization. And he thought for a moment and he said, "I didn't know there were any." That's a good idea. So again, at the core of all this brutality is this hyper-developed sense of self. So, when it's... selfing is like a disease that's killing us. Cultivating selflessness, or an infinitely expanded self, it's not only a lovely experience and something that's kind of neat to do on meditation retreats, but I actually think that our long-term survival as a species may actually hinge upon it, breaking out of this this contracted anusya. So what I would like to do is to step back from all this a little bit and look at this self-identity that we have that's so strong from an evolutionary perspective. Look at that in a little more detail. Over a million years ago, the human brain became large and complex and malleable. And its ability to learn from fellow creatures and fellow people and from the environment around us, it just increased exponentially. And I think since then, human evolution has had less to do with genes in DNA. It's less to do with growth of stronger bones or claws or body parts, and has everything to do with changes in consciousness, changes in how we train the malleable minds of our children. In English, the word consciousness has two very different meanings. One of the meanings of consciousness is awareness. I think I mentioned this earlier. So you lose consciousness means you lose awareness. And in the suttas, when you see the word consciousness, most often that means awareness. So it says, eye consciousness is different than ear consciousness. Eye awareness is different than ear awareness. Well, obviously true. The other meaning of the word consciousness is how we process information and assign meaning to it. So if you have a 5-year-old and a 15-year-old and a 50-year-old walking down the street together, I think I mentioned this the other day too, they're looking out all of the same world, right? But the world they experience inside is very, very different because they process information and assign meaning to it in very, very different ways. When a Tea Party enthusiast and a progressive look out on the political scene, they may see the same data, but they're looking at a very different world because they process it and put it together quite differently. So when we talk about the evolution of consciousness, we're talking about the evolution and how we process information and assign meaning to it. And there is a growing body of people, Claire Graves, Ken Wilber, and on, who have been studying and trying to map out how consciousness has evolved. So I want to walk you through some of those stages. Probably hundreds of thousands of years ago, when our ancestors were those furtive creatures living in the primeval forest, some of them had some instincts that bound them together. It just got them to look after one another. And this gave rise to what's now called tribal consciousness. Tribal consciousness has no individuality. It has no sense of self as we understand it. In tribal consciousness, the sense of self is actually fused with the tribe, with the traditions, with the wisdom passed down from the ancestors. They operate as a unit. So this instinct to cooperate together helped them live longer, help them adapt more than just living as isolated individuals. So it became, you know, successful and was passed down. But some of the difficulties with it is actually not terribly flexible. So in times of rapid change, it has difficulty adapting to shifts in circumstances. So somewhere between 5,000-10,000 years ago, maybe back 15, there was a new consciousness that began to emerge out of this, which has been called magic heroic consciousness. And with it is actually the beginnings of a sense of self. There were some rare individuals who had impulses, feelings, ideas that did not actually merge with a tribal mindset. And rather than filter it out, they acted upon it. And it felt powerful. It felt almost magical. All children grow through this magical, heroic stage. It's if we had a child here, you know, and I showed him these two Buddhas, there's a gold one in front and the dark one behind, and ask him to draw a picture of what this looks like to me, he would have the gold one in front and the larger brown one behind. Before about the age of 5, we are intellectually incapable of actually taking that image, putting it in our mind, turning around and looking at it from the other side. So what happens in this, this magical heroic consciousness is heroic leaders, they don't intentionally disregard the thoughts of others. They just don't quite have the capability that anybody would see things any differently than they do. So, for example, Menelaus, king of Sparta, had a wife named Helen who ran off with Paris, this wayward prince of Troy. Menelaus was upset about that, and he went to get her, wanted to get his wife back. And all the armies followed him into the Trojan Wars. And it doesn't seem like anybody stopped to think, is this in the best interest of the average Spartan citizen to go to war and have a lot of us die for the sake of getting this guy's wife back? Ours is not to question why, ours is but to do or die. Hoorah! Off they go. I was in the gym talking with this guy. He was an ex-special forces. And we have this good conversation. He stopped right in the middle of it, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're a thinker." And I got it. He self-identified as a doer. I mean, he was an intelligent, nice guy, but he was perfectly comfortable in letting a chain of command do the thinking for him. So other examples, just to give some other examples of this magic heroic consciousness, it would include the Egyptian pharaohs, you know, the gods, whatever they wanted, we do that. Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, feudal systems, Jesus as savior, magical powers. In modern times, we have street gangs. Oftentimes, they operate out of that consciousness. Villains in James Bond's movies. Wild rock stars. Frontier mentality. In children, you can see it in parallel play. You know, the terrible twos.
What about Hitler?
No. That's a little different. We'll get to that one. Okay. It has some of those elements.
Because they had some magical beliefs.
Yeah, they did have some magical thinking. He's sort of a halfway in between there. Maybe. I'll have to think about that. These heroic cultures, they were much more adaptable in battle and times of change, so they tended to survive better than the tribal consciousness, the more rigid tribal consciousness that preceded them. But they had some limitations, and it's not hard to imagine what they are. So if you picture all of these Spartan soldiers rowing their boats back from the Trojan Wars, and all the spoils of war went to Menelaus and his inner circle. They didn't even think about, you know, the average guy down there. Many of them were killed or maimed. So as the tribes grew larger, and more people risked their lives, they got very little in return. That was a huge limitation. So in order for these larger and larger groups to survive, you couldn't put a city together on a tribal heroic consciousness. So in order for larger groups to form, a different consciousness had to come in. So the new consciousness that emerged expanded the circle of caring from me to us. Today we call this traditional, or literal or mythic consciousness. Traditional consciousness is probably the one we know best. And traditional consciousness cares a lot about its own people. We take care of our own. And to accomplish this shift, what they did was put the power to make rules and customs and make these decisions. They took it out of a self-centric boss and put it up in the skies. And they imagined up in the skies and an ancient god who cared about all his people. So, for example, Yahweh, you think of the 12 tribes of Israel, Yahweh emerged as a trans-tribal god. Before that, all the tribes had different gods, and so they were going to squabble each other. But as Yahweh emerged as a trans-tribal god, when the tribes met, they had something in common. They had Yahweh under which they could cooperate. And so these rules came down from Yahweh, and they applied to everyone, including the leaders. And so you got a little more equitable distribution. And this consciousness allowed much larger groups, like cities and nations, to form. The rules that came down from on high were usually rigid, quite literal, authoritarian, and group-centric, right, rather than self-centric. So examples today include ethnocentrism, love or to leave it patriotism, fundamentalism of all stripes, the image of Jesus as lawgiver, Lake Wobegon, right? Traditional values, and one of the recent ones to emerge is actually ISIS. So we go up to move forward about, you know, many thousands of years. It wasn't until the middle of the 17th century that the next stage began to emerge. And it's called modern or rational consciousness. And in modern consciousness, it includes me, us, and them. So the idea was here that God's laws could be discerned not just by studying ancient texts, but by looking around at the world itself. So, for example, Galileo, when he was interested in how nature worked, rather than studying the Bible, he looked through his telescope just to see for himself. Modern consciousness gave rise to the scientific method, carefully measured experience. And this consciousness is more concerned with bottom-line results and is really willing to throw aside ancient authority if it needs it to get there. So, magic heroic is a self-centric, first-person me perspective. Mythic, literal, traditional consciousness is a you and me and the heck with them, a second-person perspective. And modern rational is a world-centric, third-person objective, you, me, and them perspective. And it was wildly successful. Over the span of probably not much more than 100 years, maybe 150 years, slavery was outlawed in all modern civilizations. We'd had slavery since, you know, the beginning of history and prehistory. Science extended human life by several decades. Examples of modern consciousness include the Western Enlightenment, emerging middle class, Jesus as tradition breaker, you know, threw the money changers out of the temple, scientific revolution, industrial revolution, Wall Street, Monroe Doctrine, the advertising industry, chambers of commerce, transnational corporations. I'm sorry, you okay? The advances in modern science and the Western Enlightenment are really hard to overestimate. But by the end of the middle of the 20th century, some of their limitations were becoming clearer and clearer. Transnational corporations, for example, they use, you know, rational thinking, advanced technology of the day, and they were really interested in understanding other people so they could exploit them. So many of them overlooked the well-being of others, ravaged the environment if it suited their spreadsheets. So in the middle of the 20th century, there was another consciousness that began to emerge. They didn't know what to call it, so they called it postmodern. But it's pluralistic, so I like to call it postmodern pluralism. And postmodern pluralism truly values everyone. It values taking care of the oppressed rather than exploiting them. It values feelings. It values decisions by consensus, collaboration. Everything is beautiful in its own way. Postmodern pluralism gave rise to the civil rights movement, to feminism, gay rights, other liberations movements. Other examples include Jesus as humanitarian, Greenpeace, ACLU, Doctors Without Borders, deep ecology, sensitivity training, the Occupy Wall Street movement. So, I know this is a lot. We'll get back to meditation in a minute. Let me take a pause here and just step back, because these first five stages collectively researchers call these first-tier consciousness. So as we go from tribal to heroic to traditional to modern rational to postmodern pluralism, each stage is, as you can see, becomes more inclusive and more complex. So inclusivity and complexity are measures of maturity. However, the limitations of all these stages is that they all believe that their way of thinking is the only reasonable one, and that people at lower stages must be Neanderthal or stupid or something, and people at higher stages are just kind of spaced out New Agers lost in a psychedelic haze. They've just come ungrounded and drifted off the earth. Even the most advanced of these is postmodern pluralism. It really has a lot of difficulty understanding how other people think that don't think like they do. It values other people, but it doesn't understand them. So if we look around the world today, what we see mostly, particularly in the developed world, are these last three stages, the traditional, the modern rational, and pluralism. And they are trying to destroy each other. They are just at each other's throats. Our attempt to impose a modern democracy on Iraq, it was a disaster as far as I'm concerned. Iraq was a bunch of tribes that were brought together under one heroic or supervillain strongman. And they were so far that it just didn't work. And, you know, in similar ways, if you just look at conflicts around the world, they are usually between groups who center in different stages of consciousness. So at the end of the 20th century, we're getting close here, the end of the 20th century, there was a new stage that emerged. They call it second tier integral, which understands empathetically how other people think. Right? It can talk to other consciousnesses on their own terms without being patronizing. Okay. What it does is it recognizes different stages as developmental. And it also recognizes the different ways of thinking are appropriate in different circumstances. So, for example, if these buildings caught on fire, we could have a pluralistic meeting, and we can sit around and we will sing "We Shall Overcome," and we'll check in and see how everyone feels, because we value feelings, and we will go around and we'll brainstorm and make a collection of ideas about how we might deal with this fire, and then see if we can come to a consensus on the order that that we do them, and then see if we can get any volunteers that want to help.
You mean grab a hose and turn it on?
See, we have an heroic leader over here. What you really want under fire is a heroic leader is willing to stand up and say, look, you know, you get the kids, you call the fire department, you make sure everybody else is out of the building, and everybody move. So this next stage of consciousness is called integral because it can hold in its mind and integrate lots of different ways of thinking, lots of different systems and ways of thinking, without losing track of its own. And without more integral consciousness, I think humanity is going to tear itself apart. Our technology is just getting too powerful. We'll just tear ourselves apart. So, we come into the 21st century. Is this the apex? You know, have we gone as far as we can go? Or is there more? To think that human evolution is going to stop here is really kind of silly. We you know, in the coming years and decades of children and grandchildren, I think we're going to see new, more complex, more inclusive kinds of consciousnesses emerging. And it can be as difficult for us to imagine. It can seem as far out for us to imagine as it is for, say, a tribal consciousness to imagine pluralistic consciousness. But there's a little bit of data out there indicating what third tier, what the next one to emerge might look like. In the second tier in integral consciousness, what we have is the ability to step outside our own way of thinking and look objectively at the way other people think. What seems to happen in third tier is that self-identity starts to become unmoored from any particular consciousness. It comes unmoored for it and extends out beyond one body, one personality, one set of habits, one way of thinking, one particular style, one set of memories, and it includes more and more and more. Thierry de Chardin, in his mystical merge with the natural world, I think is the example I could come up with when I was trying to think of what that actually looks like. So when he was out there with, you know, looking at those bugs and spiders and trees and stuff like that, he wasn't just observing nature, he wasn't just appreciating it. He was actually, you know, one with it. He was out there merged with it. So if that story touches any place inside you, if it resonates with you in any way, then you have a glimpse of what seems to be emerging. So for most of us, that sort of that experience are usually kind of peak experiences. You know, we have a moment of it. In third tier, what looks like happens is that that perspective, that way of seeing things, becomes a more or less permanent way of looking at things.
I'm going to go turn on the third tier water hose.
Good to see you. So third tier has been called transcendence because it seems to move beyond any one individual sense of self. It's kind of innocent beginnings and identify more with larger groups of organisms. So what does all this have to do with meditation? This project we're on here. Some people would say nothing, because meditation seems to be mostly about cultivating states of awareness, while consciousness is about stages of consciousness, different ways of thinking. So awareness roughly deepens. There are different spectrums. So awareness deepens from sort of ordinary awareness of the physical world, sight, sound, smells, etc., to subtle awareness of the subtle realms, thoughts, feelings, emotions, inspirations, to the very subtle, beginning to see the movements of the mind itself, to pure awareness, which is awareness of awareness. So sort of gross or ordinary to subtle, very subtle, pure. Consciousness, on the other hand, moves from tribal to heroic to traditional to modern rational to postmodern pluralism to integral to transcendent. They just are not the same thing. Meditation is mostly about states of awareness. Maturity is about stages of consciousness. Meditation is about waking up. Consciousness is about growing up. Meditation is about cleansing the mirror of awareness. Consciousness is about how we interpret what we see in that mirror. Most of the Buddha's teachings are about awareness. The jhanas are about cleansing the mirror of awareness so it goes deeper and deeper and deeper until we can see that pure awareness. His teachings on suffering and impermanence, they're all things that we can see and experience directly. But his teachings on anatta, on selflessness, is not about awareness. It's about how we interpret what we're aware of. I wonder if the Buddha was frustrated sometimes in trying to convey this. So this urge, you know, this sense of self, bhava-tanā, is so deeply wired into us. So we hear these places where he just keeps saying, stop interpreting, there's no me, there's no mind, there's no myself. Stop the workings of consciousness. Just see things directly as they are. In the Chichaka Sutta, Majjhima-nikāya number 148, the Buddha says, the eye is impermanent. It comes and goes in time. There is no permanent self in the eye. To think the eye of self is just wrong. Light is impermanent. It comes and goes. There is no permanent self there. To think light is self is just wrong. Seeing is impermanent. It comes and goes. There is no permanent self there. To think seeing as self is just wrong. And he drones on, given every possible combination of sensation, feeling, liking and disliking, and he keeps saying about each of them, there is no self there. To think there's a self there is just wrong. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated is, the word is untenable in his translation, but that seems more academic. The Buddha is just saying it's just wrong. It takes over an hour to read the whole sutta. It was as if he was trying to pound it into the heads of the monks. Stop interpreting. Stop creating the sense of self. Stop constructing sandcastles in the air, please. To appreciate why the Buddha used this strategy, you have to remember that in his time, the highest stage of consciousness that was generally available was traditional literal. This is the consciousness of most modern-day fundamentalists. And there was a little bit probably magic heroic in there. That's what was around. That was available for the most part in the general population. And this consciousness has a very, very strong sense of self. If you think of fundamentalist consciousness, there's us and them, good guys and bad guys. It's very, very solid. The Buddha himself, I don't know where he was. You know, he may have been modern rational. He kept on saying, you have to experience the self, you have to work it out on your own. That's a modern rational value that has nothing to do with a traditional, literal, insistence on ancient authorities. It could be that he was, postmodern, pluralistic, or integral, or more. We're actually never going to know. There's no way to know, because he didn't write anything down. All we know is what other people told us, he said. So it's like me. If I went to a lecture by Stephen Hawking, and came a few days later to tell you what Stephen Hawking was saying, what I could convey to you would be severely limited by my understanding of theoretical physics. So the followers of the Buddha, what they could pass on, what they could understand and codify, was severely limited by this traditional literal consciousness. And you'll see a lot of that in the suttas. Unless you're willing to read between the lines, then that becomes very interesting. Well, yes, Mr. Fireman.
We know historically that the Buddha created a community of females that he called bhikkhunis.
Right.
We also know that he included in both sanghas for men and women some people from every walk of life and
right.
every race. He also spoke in the common dialect of the day and didn't use the sacred language as the sacred text. So modern
postmodern pluralism. Yeah. And I wonder about integral, you know, but certainly there are the modern and those and the postmodern pluralism. You know, we take care of everybody. Everybody's beautiful in its own way. It's you can see all that
well,
in
they
there.
Didn't hug, so I think you're.
But I think to include untouchables in the Sangha, you know, with Brahmins. Is their version is a close they got. They may not sing everything was beautiful, but in that time that was way out of the cultural norm. Despite all those obstacles, the Buddha seemed to do okay with it. You know, lots of people seemed to have woken up around him. So I'm coming to the end here. Our situation today, I think, is quite different, you know, than in the Buddha's time. In the sanghas that I've been a part of and seen, the center of gravity, the most common consciousness you see there is this postmodern pluralism. It's there, you know, the one that values feelings, taking care of the oppressed, decisions by consensus, ecology. Everything is relative. Everything is beautiful in its own way. All these pluralistic values, that's the center of gravity of many of the sanghas that I've been involved with. In the general population in the developed world, about 20% of the people are postmodern pluralists, and only about 5% are integral. But I think in our sanghas, the percentages are probably higher. So, that means that we're not that far away from this third-tier transcendence. Right? Many of you have certainly had glimpses. So in meditation, the times when your awareness becomes very clear, pure, luminous, awareness that feels closer to who you are than anything you've ever experienced, any memory you have, anything you've ever felt, because it's the awareness that attended to those memories, had those experiences. Awareness feels kind, clear, very intimate. At the same time, it feels, you know, impersonal, like it's larger than just what I'm aware of here. And then it fades. Right? So in the third tier, as I was saying before, that kind of awareness seems to become more or less a permanently abiding state. And if you've had a taste of it, you're probably not that far from it.
Could you define that third tier thing again? You mentioned transcendence and
yeah, what seems to happen in third tier is, just talking about sense of self, is that it comes. So, if you go back, say, tribalism, you know, self identity doesn't exist. The identity is with the tribe. And if you look at, let's say, you know, traditional consciousness. There's a very, very strong identity, you know, with the group. What happens in third tier is the identity seems to come loose from. So if any of you have sat in meditation and looked at your thoughts and say, wow, where did those come from? You know, sometimes they seem a little foreign. It's like your identity is coming loose from your own thinking. So in third tier, that's what happens, is that the awareness tends to come loose from your particular way of thinking, and begins to spread out and include everything. So from that perspective, what's happening here in this room is here there is actually only one awareness, but it's looking through different perspectives. You have awareness looking through Susan's perspective, through Sandy's perspective. And we can see that, and it seems like a nice idea. But what happens is it spreads out where that becomes not just a kind of a romantic ideal. But so within that awareness, there's the awareness itself and the particular perspective that it's looking through. Right? And what happens is the identification with a particular perspective loosens. And it tends to reside in the awareness itself, which seems to be beyond any particular point of view. Does that make sense? A little bit? So, one of the things that we can do is rather than fight against the sense of self that is evolutionarily so deeply inbred into us, rather than push against it, is just relax into it. Soften into that sense of self, and then soften into those evolutionary forces moving us towards transcendence, soften into this sense of expanding out. So rather than kind of shrink down into the self, we just let the sense of self expand out and out to include more and more people. The more people that we include, the less there's any feeling of separation between us. And that's really all the Buddha taught. That there is no self that separates us. So if it expands out and includes everyone, it accomplishes the same thing. Shall we try it for a few minutes? What the heck? Right. So just sit comfortably, close your eyes. You know, and you know, as any thoughts or images come up, don't worry about them. Just sort of gently siksar them.
Are you guiding us?
Yeah, I'm going to guide you through this. Everybody but you. You can do your own thing.
I'll go get the fire hose. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just siksar, you know. And send out peacefulness, well-being. Let it radiate out. And then, rather than just sending out or just watching that flow of well-being spread out, flow out with it. Let your sense of self just gently expand. What would that be like? Have a self that includes, you know, the larger space around that body that you've been walking around with. Let it spread out even more. To include all the people here in the room, all of us. And let it expand out further. As if the wind blowing through the trees is blowing through you as well. It's almost like if you look down inside yourself, there are the trees and the building and the surrounding countryside. And let it expand out and out. And as it expands out, it gets thinner and lighter. The sense of self gets thinner and lighter. Just let the awareness becomes less and less my awareness or your awareness, and just the awareness. awareness, listening through your ears, through your mind. Maybe the same awareness as that. My mind. Different perspective, same awareness. Let go of the perspective. Just be with the awareness. Birds, wind, grasses in the fields, all within this awareness. Comments, thoughts.
Shoulders relax real quickly. Just relax right now.
It's great.
Dissolution of everything is very pleasant.
Yes. Pure awareness. Joyful may be too strong a term, but it really has that kind of buoyant quality to it. I can be walking along, kind of gnarled up in my own little problems, and without doing anything with them, just kind of let my sense of self expand out there to touch some of that pure awareness. Those little gnarly problems continue, and I feel buoyant. So the identity goes out into that.
And it's so easy to extend into a sort of beautiful space that sort of continues.
Yeah.
There is a sense of relaxation, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Also hard to let go of the perspectives because there's confusion between awareness and perspectives.
Yeah. So that's kind of where the edge is for most of us. And so some of it is just taking the perspectives with just a little kind of lightness or sense of humor. Ah, I know that one. Why should I believe my own thoughts? They're just thoughts. So because if you try to get rid of the perspective, then that just creates more tension. So it's just letting it float. Just let it soften. So I've got about a dozen more talking points here, but I think I've said quite enough. So I do want to give some more time for you to respond, because I did dump a lot on you all at once.
There's one phrase that seems to me came out of the Upanishads. It's by the way, the phrase is Atman is Brahma, where Brahma is. Oh.
So my thoughts on that? Sounds pretty good to me. Language can be so awkward in all this, it's hard to find it. Ralph Waldo Emerson, he wrote, see if I can get this, standing on the bare ground, my head uplifted in the blithe air, the currents of the universal being circulate through me. I become a transparent eyeball. And, you know, it just, you know, it sounds kind of gory. I mean, I just picture this eyeball, you know, like a volleyball with these nerve endings coming from it. But, you know, if I let go of my standing outside it and thinking, what was going through that guy's mind? What was he experiencing that caused him, you know, to write those words?
Peyote.
Pardon?
Peyote.
Could be, yeah. He was out there. He was out there. He was also a Unitarian minister, by the way, which is... Yes, yes. Yes. Yes, the transcendentalists were a huge part of our movement.
There's sort of a convention that has sort of evolved over the past 10 years that I noticed. And you can pick it up here and there. And just it manifests in this way that I refer to as the one and the many.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, I guess, a philosophical didactic that you guys could probably talk more about than I do. But it's a sort of, you hear it around certain areas, and somebody will say, yeah, well, we're in a bubble here. You know, when you leave the Bay Area, it's different there. And so, and also you hear it in the media, media talks about the Beltway media. Politicians talk about the liberal echo chamber or the right-wing echo chamber. And so there's a sort of understanding of sort of this, call it this, you know, a type of culture or an understanding. And then there is the other, okay? And so, but whether you identify with one or the other, you're actually identifying with both of them. Just acknowledging the bubble means I'm either in it or out of the bubble. They're either in or out of the bubble. But you're acknowledging the two sort of, these two worlds, or maybe even three.
Mm-hmm.
So is that what you mean when you say pluralism, or is this a third tier?
Pluralism is a different ways of describing it, but it's a genuine, full third-person perspective where different people and different perspectives are valued. And pluralism, where it started to come apart, is very, very big on relativism. You know, everything is relative. You hear that a lot. And so, sort of an example of where it starts to come apart is they might say, you know, well, everybody can believe what they want. All perspectives are the same. White supremacy, you know, world community, they're just points of view. Everything is beautiful in its own way. right? So the difficulty where it fell apart and where... Ken Wilber says it's philosophical, it's technical, but it's kind of cute, is that Pluralism says there are no absolutes. Everything is relative. Except our idea that everything is relative. And so it starts to fall apart at its own thing. And what the integral comes to is says, yes, there are differences, and it can acknowledge those and actually make some kind of intelligent, discerning things, decisions. And it's usually based on, you know, inclusivity and complexity. So white supremacy is less mature because it's less inclusive and rather simplistic, while world community includes more.
So what you're talking about is education in order to get us to kill our kids from obliterating ourselves is education. It seems that when people understand there are many options than the ones that they're familiar with, then they can make a better decision about how they want to live or how they want to vote or who they want to spend time with.
Yeah, I would agree with you if we're saying that education is helping people learn how to think in more and more complex ways, as opposed to, for example, from the traditional perspective, education is a matter of passing on information that you're supposed to absorb. Right, yeah, and see if you can regurgitate it, you know, properly. But if you mean by education, actually genuinely working with.
Well, you were talking about how we become consumers because the money isn't involved in manipulating us to buy the products so that they become, you know, the corporations become more powerful. We just do what they ask us to do. And there's a lot of advertisement out there to feel good when we consume well. And I don't think there's a lot that goes against it. Well, I guess there is the pluralism.
Yeah, so there can be a specific issue. What happens with higher, more mature stages is that it's really more, it looks more at the process. So, for example, part of the difficulty of the consciousness and stages of consciousness is that if you look at stages of kinds of awareness, we can move in and out of all kinds of awareness we do throughout the day. Right.
Not only that, we have a young society that permits and encourages the formation of capital, which provides huge power, which then essentially takes over the whole of the society from the top, and at that point imposes covertly a way of life and values and manipulation of politics and the world view of these.
Yeah, so
but then there's the grassroots thing that's anti that.
Yeah, and the grassroots is more pluralistic. But let me just stages of consciousness emerge slowly. If you are pluralistic and you understand what integral is and you want to move yourself into it and you're willing to work hard on it, the research on it says it takes about 5 years because it's not about, you can teach people different points of view, but it's really about how you think. And so it's a matter of reorganizing the consciousness, how you process information. And so one of the things that helps move people along
to get from one level of consciousness to another?
Takes about 5 years. Takes about 5 years. If you were interested.
You go from tribal to the next one in 5 years.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Pardon?
I just an expression of dismay for our society.
Yeah. So one of the things that seems to speed it up as much as anything is actually meditation. Because what happens when the meditation goes deep, your consciousness, how you process information, begins to come apart, and then it comes back together. And so you kind of get used to this of consciousness and how you structure things becoming more fluid. And that seems to loosen it up so that people can move through these more quickly if they're interested.
What's the country that has a minister? His stat is gross domestic happiness.
Bhutan, yeah. Yeah, and so those are some of the types of things that are coming out. They're doing this.
So, trying to interpret in the context of this talk. So, are we also saying that the people who were around Buddha at the time of Buddha understood things in a different manner because they were in different consciousness, and today because we are in different consciousness, we might need to reorganize the way we think about this whole thing to some degree?
Yeah. So this gets controversial. The way Ken Wilber puts it, it's sort of redefining enlightenment. So it said if you took an arahat from the Buddha's time, you know, in a culture that could be misogynistic, you know, et cetera, and, you know, and brought them up into the 21st century, it just wouldn't fly. And there's been a lot of problems, you know, when some of the Asian masters, you know, came over here that were very, very exquisitely trained in terms of moving up through states of awareness, but were basically in a mythic literal consciousness, and then came over with students who were very interested in learning all these states of awareness, but who were, you know, modern or pluralistic, for whom, you know, sexism and ethnocentrism and all that stuff was just, you know, primitive. And so part of... this gets into a long thing. I'll just do it quickly. But part of it is taking responsibility for who you're learning what from. So you could still go to one of those teachers and learn lots about cultivating higher states of awareness, but you would not necessarily sit down on their feet, you know, to ask them how to vote, you know, on marriage equality or, you know, or whatever, yeah, or something like that. So the states and the stages are really very different lines of development. However, I think once you start moving into that transcendent consciousness, as they start merge back together, because that's how you see things and how they integrate. I don't think they can be quite separate, but you know where we are down, and particularly in first tier, they can be very separate.
So one sort of practical implication I see for myself is that when I meditate, a lot of past conflicts come up, which are like. Mm-hmm. Minor discussions here, minor argument here and there, mm-hmm. which kind of you need to deal with in your mm-hmm. meditation. And if you apply yourself more towards the third tier or transcendental mm-hmm. Sort of consciousness, then you're caring for other people's point of view. And if you live that kind of life, then next time you come for a retreat, you'll probably have less of those to deal with or less recent ones to deal with it.
Yes. What's being suggested here is that how you process information is something, if we, you know, really want to be mature, relatively awake, is that you have to pay attention to that as well. You just can't escape it. You can't do just the awareness.
One more question. So, the meditation which we tried like a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. is that something you recommend doing? Or, and plus a related question is that sometimes people talk about space meditation, which is kind of spending out into space. Is this related to that, or is this different?
Yeah, I have a tremendous amount of respect for, you know, what the Buddha taught and the way this came down. And so I'm a little reluctant to try to fuse this back into that. But, you know, to be healthy, aware, it's not just, you know, training a particular kind of meditation, you know, to treat your body well. I mean, what you eat, you know, exercise, how you relate to people in the world. There are many different modalities that to really be an effective world citizen, or however you want to phrase that, we have to look at. And so I think it's valuable to take something like this, you know, the expansive thing, and to do that as well at times. So you can do it in your meditation. I mean, certainly the fifth jhana, the base of infinite space, has that expansiveness, and it has kind of implicitly the way it's described, the self here, and then everything expands out from that. It's just like loosening up where that self is. And many of you will report and have, you know, experiences of, you know, the sense of self getting, you know, a little loose in there. And to just sort of acknowledge that's happening, and that's probably relatively healthy. If you have huge emotional problems, and I don't see anybody here like that, but have all kinds of, you know, internal, conventional, psychological stuff running around. You know, I worked with street kids for a while, around a counseling center for street kids, and I don't know that I would have them do an infinitely expanded self. They had tremendous access to just about all their feelings. They just didn't know how to organize them. So what you actually want with somebody doing this is somebody who can operate, you know, well in the conventional world, and then can spread beyond it. Well, as Gurdjieff used to say, I think it was Gurdjieff, he said he always wanted to work with, what do you call it? Oh, well-adjusted malcontents. You know, people who actually could navigate, you know, the world and manage it well, but wanted more. If you have somebody that just can't make it in the world and can't figure out how to, you know, make a living and stuff like that, I want to do spirituality so I just don't have to deal with that anymore. It doesn't work so well. But if you have somebody well integrated, then I think these expansive things can be very helpful. Play around with it and see. My sense of it is that, you know, these are things that I think are very important, and they're just beginning to emerge, and we're all just experimenting at this point.
The talk actually also kind of suggests that gives a feel like that meditation is not an escape route from the whole thing that's going on, because one view could be that you keep meditating, and then hence once you reach nirvana or liberation, then you have an exit out of that freeway. So
yeah, and what I would say about that is good luck, because what happens, I mean, as you all know, as awareness softens and opens, it becomes more and more sensitive, and so I'm here and feeling more peaceful, and then you find you're having a real hard time over there, and it becomes harder and harder to just kind of ignore that, and so there's compassion, you know, for your suffering, and there's also equanimity in terms of seeing if there's something I can do about that. And so I don't think that this stuff really evolves with us, you know, in a steel egg someplace separated from everything else. It just naturally just opens up that way. And, as I said, I think on the very first night, if you think this is going to help you avoid your personal problems, you have my condolences, you know, because this thing will tend to expose all those. It just brings them up. And hopefully, you know, learn a much more wholesome way to relate to them. But
what's really interesting is that the IT industry seems to be taking up Vipassana and meditation on a much greater scale than and then the other industry. And it's really interesting to see these gifted people who are running around with very different states of consciousness as a result of their experiences, and wonder what that's going to do when they become into managerial positions and stuff like that. But hopefully they'll spread them up.
Well, if you look at the values in the 20-somethings, it's very different than the older generation, and there's a much more pragmatic view of actually dealing with the world, not from an ideological perspective, but figure out what works. So as I used to tell my congregations, you know, our job, you know, for people like me in their 60s, is just trying to keep things together until this generation, can come up.
They're much more inclusive. My daughter's 27, and we talk about this a lot.
Yeah.
And I had her very young. So in some reason, I mean, I was only 22 or 3 when she was born. And so there's, you know, on a calendar, there's not a big gap, but our minds are in very, very different places.
Right.
And she talks a lot about how there's this whole communal world going on that people 35 and older don't typically have access to because they're not in that mind space.
So that's the millennials.
Yeah, you can't get it to live alone.
The millennials are in their 20s.
Can't get it to live alone.
Right, and then there's the Generation X, which is between the baby boomers and the millennials. So you're talking about the millennium, right? Not the generation, not the
The 20 years.
So that's the millennium.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it's the difference too.
Yeah.
Big companies are for big companies.
Big what?
Big companies organizing their workforce. They're definitely making room for this generation to come in. And the way they work, actually the way they organize physically in the office space, et cetera. Drastically different.
The guy that owns and runs Zappos, if you care to look this up, he basically made the announcement that he is decentralizing the entire company, and it was literally, this is the direction we're going, and if you don't like it, then don't work here anymore. He had a really long manifesto where he went in, it's over 20 pages long. It's an interesting read because he very much embraced that whole thing, and he basically said, I think this way is going to make more sense for us, and it's the direction of everything is going anyway, so here we go.
Yeah.
Zappos, they make shoes.
So, relating this back to meditation, thoughts?
Yeah, so is meditation, I mean, at least this type of meditation, you sort of view it as a formula for fast-tracking critical thinking.
I don't think I've formulated that thought. I think you have.
I'm asking the question.
Yes, I know. So you asked me if I... For...
The answer
now. No, I haven't thought of it that way. So I was just taking a moment to. I do think this type of meditation can help get much clearer kinds of thinking.
Definitely.
And, and one thing you notice about this process, infinitely expanding self, we start very early on sending out metta. So there's something about it that just actually kind of sets up a kind of resonance in that direction.
It goes from me to me and you, from me and you to the many, the near, the middle, the far, and then all.
Yeah.
And then the sense of self becomes not less important, but equally important.
Well, it could for different people, but so what I'm talking is just taking it one step further, because the language of the instructions, at least traditionally, have been implied us here, sending it to them there. And so what I'm suggesting here is that you know, at times, I guess you can do it a little bit, you know, in a sitting, of just not keep your sense of self here, but imagine it really all flowing out together and just see what happens.
But also, I would expect, I mean, I don't see how people can avoid learning empathy doing meta practices, mm-hmm. because it's pressing the empathy button every yeah. time you do that. Mm-hmm. And I would expect people to have much deeper levels of sense of feelings about empathy, mm-hmm. having done that, because it's opened up it up as a reality, mm-hmm. which is why some people I know, even you know, some people I know who are meditators, mm-hmm. don't like this particular strand, because particularly for some men, it's really not egosyntonic to feel love towards other people. It's got to be, oh, well, it can be advisable, it's like quite jolly, blah, 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 but the actual empathetic affection aspect of it is really taboo for them, or yeah, really okay. threatening.
Yeah. Actually, a question very much related to how my mind and my dad deal, which is, to what degree it seems to me, from my own experience, and I've heard it would make sense to me narratively, is that to really have empathy, meaningful empathy for somebody else, you have to, you don't have to. It seems like it's helpful to have had a lot of deep suffering. If you've gone through some deep suffering, mm-hmm. it's much easier to be empathetic for somebody else than to express compassion, to wish compassion for others.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
It's a state of mind when you haven't experienced yourself. So.
I think there is. We could add one more thing to it. Is you may not have, like, in ordinary terms, you may not have suffered, like, excruciatingly, like you were tortured or something. Mm-hmm. But if you have looked at your suffering, then in whatever level of suffering you have had, if you look at it, that makes you empathetic also.
Right. Yeah, there can be this thing that says, you know, you have to have had your leg cut off to have empathy with somebody else who has their leg cut off. So, yeah. No, I was...
I've never been a drug addict, but I can definitely experience empathy for their level of despair
right.
and depression and suffering.
Right.
Because suffering is suffering.
Yes.
Suffering here is you can connect with somebody else's suffering.
Yeah.
If you've done your work, because some people go into... martyrdom, and I think a lot of where what happens today is the problem around the consumerism, because we don't look at our pain, we want to just avoid it and go into what was me, so I'm going to go buy a new car instead of really feeling the empathy. And so if we do our work, I think empathy can get very deep, but we can also, I think, avoid it, which a lot of us do.
Yes, and I agree, you know, completely, just want to underline it, because if we haven't really touched the roots of our own suffering, then we can't be that much help, actually, to healing the larger suffering in the world.
Countries, they come in from right. Uganda, all over. But they're also, they do a week-long camp every summer, and they also are mixed in with local high school kids from Austin. Mm-hmm. It's a real interesting mix. And she was saying how there are kids that are coming in, one girl had half of her face blown off. I mean, they're just the most horrendous stories from these war-torn countries. And then there are girls that are cheerleaders at the high school in a high school in Austin, they're saying, they're suffering just as much because there's so much pressure on them to have sex or to take drugs, and they feel like they're not pretty enough, and they are really suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying, well, how do you address that? Because they're both suffering, but I guess there's levels or layers, but The girls at the high school are just as convinced that their lives are just very sad and depressing.
Well, part of it is being able, the thing with having half your face blown away is actually for us to get past whatever our reflexive horror is. Wavy Gravy has a story. You know, it was a clown. He used to go into the children's wings where all these kids have been burned badly. And he said he walked in, you know, and there was this kid who was lying down in the crib, had bit third-degree burns over like three-quarters of his body. And it was like, you know, he was there to cheer him up, and it was like just kind of froze inside and was trying to figure out what to do. And this other little kid came by on a skateboard, you know, and looked in there and looked at him and looked and said, "Man, you is ugly." And they both laughed, you know. And then Wavy Gravy sort of broke out of his trance and stuff. But it's, you know, it's that capacity to actually look through, you know, past the suffering. Because the other thing about the suffering is that's all you see. You're not going to be of any help. You have to be able to see the suffering, and you have to be able to see the light, or whatever you want to call it, you know, the depth beyond that, and make connection with that in both, and then, you know, in a place we can do some. Pardon? Exactly. Right. So we're coming up on 2 hours here. I have one reading for you at the end, but I just want to see if there's other things, particularly from those who haven't spoke, not to put anybody on the spot, but...
Mm-hmm. There, originally.
Both here and there.
And so bring it back to that is what's true.
Mm-hmm.
What's really true.
Yeah.
And I think that that is timeless, that the Buddha today would still ask that question, that still is very present and alive for us to do that in our inquiry, what is true. And since I'm talking, I'll just add my little two cents here, is I think he would add, he would talk more about love if he were alive today.
Yeah. I don't know if I said this before, but the in terms of states of awareness, from what we can see, those have been known for thousands and thousands of years. And in the mystical traditions, you know, have different sort of techniques for working with, train with them. But I don't think there's much that we can learn about those that hasn't been known for a long, long time. So we can really draw deeply from those traditions. The thing that's new is these evolving ways of processing information has moved quite far. And so really drawing and honoring deeply some of these ancient traditions, what they've learned, and then how to bring that into a modern context that knows that there's not much new to learn here, but there's a lot that's changed here. So you don't want to take the cultural mores of the Buddha's time. I don't mean a sanghas, but in the Buddha's time, but how we draw that into our present context.
Right, and so the last, actually, remind me the last piece I would say is then what do we choose to focus on?
Yeah.
Because we can focus on, you know, the history and blah, 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 or we can focus on what, just where do we want to point our attention?
Yeah. And I would say the same thing. I would frame it just slightly differently. I would say, is open it up deep within and seeing which way we feel drawn. And I use that word very intentionally, not pushed. You know, fear pushes us, but I think love and compassion draw us. And that if there's some draw to do something out there, if you're not working with that and acting with that in some way, that your life won't feel complete. Well,
do you recommend easing awake?
What a stupid phrase. What a stupid phrase. Yes. So anything else? It's from my journal. June 2009. I was walking through the woodland along the American River when two snakes reared up out of the grass about 8 feet from me. They were at least 4 feet long. The exposed, creamy underbelly gave little hint as to species, but the triangular head suggested venom. They were not within striking distance, so I watched fascinated. After a few minutes, I saw the back of one with a diamond pattern and a tail with a rattle. Rattlesnakes are usually shy of humans, so this puzzled me. I wondered if they were fighting each other. But as I watched, their motions seemed more affectionate than combative. They wound around each other, fell back into the grass, rose up again, wound around each other. I smiled softly. They're making love, I thought. They're too distracted to notice I'm here. I'm not particularly scared of snakes, but I had never felt so warmly towards two rattlesnakes in the wild so close to me. Snakes and humans and all sentient beings feel the urge that leads to generating life. I don't know what snakes feel, but I felt a commonality with them. It made me smile. After a while, I moved on. There were a lot of butterflies out that day, black ones with white spots. I didn't know their name, but that's fine because they didn't either. I passed one on the ground on the edge of the path. He fluttered his wings without rising in the air, just moved through the dust a few inches. I turned back to take a closer look. His wings were dusty and ragged. "Near the end of your life cycle," I whispered to him. I wanted to reach down and touch him to see if he could fly, but I couldn't imagine a big fleshy finger descending from the sky would be a pleasant experience for a butterfly, so I just observed. His wings moved slowly with his breathing. Butterflies don't live very long, but from their perspective, they live full lives. From their perspective, humans are ancient creatures who live near eternity. One day, I, like the butterfly, will be near the end of my cycle. I'm past the middle of mine, probably, and not too near the end, hopefully. I wasn't trying to empathize with the butterfly. How could I know what it feels? But I knew that eventually life ebbs from both of us. In this, we are the same. I walked down the path, leaving the butterfly to die in peace. The urge to start new life, the ebbing of life. As I gazed at the green woods and meadows around me, I felt touched to be a part of it all. My eyes were moist. I think Nietzsche, in a rare soft mood, said, "Suffering is complex, but happiness is simple." Walking through the fields, I felt simple. I felt ordinary. I felt blessed. May we all feel simple, ordinary, and blessed. May we allow our energies to spread out as they I want to do, to not hold them back. May we spread out to include all living beings so that we can look down on the planet and all the creatures inside us and say to all of us, may all of us be happy. May all of us know our interconnections. May all of us have ease. May all of us be free. May it be so.